Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 450, titled 9/11, Proxy War, and the Underground Reich, an update. This is being recorded on March 14th of the year 2004. Before I begin, very quickly, first of all, WFMU is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio, more recent programs streaming at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery, one word, DaveEmory. Older programs are available for download only on Real Audio at a longer URL, linked to both the wfmu.org/Dave Emery website and to the Real Audio-equipped For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. Spitfire List is one word, SPITFIRELIST.com. There will be a detailed, annotated, article-length description of For the Record program number 450 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website within a week or so of the airing of this program. Listeners have inquired about how to support the work that I'm doing. At the beginning of each description, there is a page to click on in order to support the work that I have been engaged in. Please be aware that Spitfire stocks all of the various tapes that I and all of the various programs and lectures I've done over the years. You can write to them by regular mail at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005, and reach them by email at mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. There is now a search engine with which listeners can search the Spitfire websites to locate a particular item in the massive body of descriptions. And also, for people that find my discussion of the Underground Reich preposterous or incredible, what have you, and I can appreciate that there might be many who would, now happily the entire book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, by the heroic late Paul Manning, is on the Spitfire website for download on Adobe PDF. And it is absolutely free. I would recommend that listeners combine an understanding of that text with other books, such as The Beast Reawakens by Martin A. Lee, The Splendid Blonde Beast by Christopher Simpson, Secret War Against the Jews by John Loftus, and, of course, Dreamer of the Day by Kevin Coogan. There are other texts as well that will flesh out their understanding, but there's never been more information about this. But now, happily, the Paul Manning book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, is available on the Spitfire website for free. So please take advantage of that. And that an understanding of that text, again, is a foundational element in grasping some of the things that we're talking about on this program. Now, again, this program is titled, basically, 9/11 Proxy War, or update on 9/11 Proxy War and the Underground Reich. We're going to be taking a look at the Underground Reich's use of populations, Muslim populations, from that vast landmass they called the Earth Island, the massive land stretching from the Straits of Gibraltar all the way across Europe and Asia to the Pacific and encompassing most of the world's landmass, most of the world's population, and most of the world's petroleum reserves. And across the middle of it is a vast stretch of Muslim population. And I believe that we are now witnessing the unfolding of a further development in what in the 19th and early 20th centuries was called the Great Game. However, I think this is a very complex event in which the Underground Reich and associated elements are looking to either destroy and or subjugate the United States, including a strategy, or at the center of that strategy, I believe, is a plan to bankrupt the United States by slashing its revenues and engaging it in a very time-consuming, costly war against the Muslim populations of the Earth Island. Again, I can appreciate this will appear insane to some people, but I think the evidence is there, and I can't stress strongly enough that people study history, study von Clausewitz, study Sun Tzu, study Machiavelli, and factor that into the discussions I've been putting on the air for all these many years and that now happily are archived. We're going to begin by taking a look at the very frightening situation vis-a-vis the spreading of nuclear technology. Albert Einstein noted in the immediate aftermath of the advent of the atomic bomb, quote, "Everything has changed but our way of thinking," unquote. That's quite true. Einstein and many others were terrified that these weapons would begin to proliferate, and now exactly that is beginning to happen, no thanks to the Reagan and Bush administrations. We're going to begin by reviewing a couple of articles we looked at in For the Record 447, this concerning both administrations of both Georges Bush and their interdiction, in some cases passive, in some cases active, of investigations into the Pakistani nuclear capability, whose development in combination with European nuclear traffickers, associated in many cases with the underground Reich, is leading to the proliferation of this technology. And sooner or later, these chickens are going to come home to roost, and those are going to be very, very well-done barbecued chickens indeed. San Francisco Chronicle, Saturday, February 28, 2004, AP story by Matt Kelly, headlined by the Chronicle, Pakistan threatened to give Iran nuclear know-how in 1990, subtitled Administration of Bush's Father Didn't Pass On Warning to Clinton. Reads in part, Pakistan warned the United States 14 years ago that it might give nuclear technology to Iran, but the administration of President Bush's father did little to follow up, former Pentagon officials say. Word of the 1990 threat from Pakistan's top general apparently was not passed along to the Clinton administration when it took office 3 years later, according to interviews by the Associated Press. One of Pakistan's top nuclear scientists admitted last month that he had sold nuclear technology to Iran, as well as North Korea and Libya, all nations on the U.S. list of terrorism sponsors. President Bush said the underground nuclear network had been exposed by U.S. and British intelligence agencies' work over the past few years. But former government arms control officials and declassified documents show the United States knew about Pakistan's nuclear procurement network since 1983 and suspected the transfers to Iran since the mid-1980s. The United States had hints of the transfers to North Korea in the mid-1990s, officials say. The clearest evidence of the Iran link came in January of 1990, when Pakistan's Army Chief of Staff conveyed his threat to arm Iran to a top Pentagon official. Henry Rowan, at the time an assistant defense secretary, said Pakistani General Mirza Aslam Beg had issued the warning at a face-to-face meeting in Pakistan. Quote, Beg said something like, If we don't get adequate support from the U.S., then we may be forced to share nuclear technology with Iran. Unquote, said Owen, now a professor at Stanford University. Skipping down, this is, by the way, the Sikorsky quoted here is Henry Sikorsky, the Pentagon's top arms control official in 1990. Sikorsky and Rowan said former President George H.W. Bush's administration had done little to follow up on Begg's warning. Quote, In hindsight, maybe before or after, that they did make some transfers, unquote, Rowan said. Ashton Carter, an assistant defense secretary from 1993 through 6, said he didn't remember even being told about the problem when he joined the Pentagon. And next, the article goes into the fact that one of the obscuring factors, one of the motivating factors for the first Bush administration to interdict warnings about the growing Pakistani nuclear capability was the fact that the Pakistanis were basically serving as a cutout in order to enable the Afghan Mujahideen fighters fighting against the Soviets in the first Afghan War of the 1980s. Later on, the fact that many of the funding conduits that had been developed in combination with the Saudis and with the Muslim Brotherhood in order to help enable the Afghan Mujahideen fighting the Soviets, when that metamorphosed into the funding conduits that helped to nourish al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden in his war against the United States, for the same reason, the Saudi connection, the investigation was actively interdicted by the second Bush administration. Turning back to what the first Bush administration didn't do, while Islamabad and Washington squabbled about the evidence, the Khan network provided sophisticated technology to Libya, North Korea, and Iran, three countries the United States considered among the most dangerous. A decade earlier, the Reagan administration had looked the other way on Pakistan's nuclear program, said Stephen Cohen, a State Department expert on the region from 1985 to 1987. Back then, Washington used Pakistan as a conduit for sending weapons and money to guerrillas fighting the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. Quote, They were covering up our involvement in Afghanistan, pretending we played no role in Afghanistan, so they expected us to cover up their role in procuring a weapon system they saw as vital to their survival, said Cohen, now with the Brookings Institution. And reviewing another article from For the Record 447, this concerning the second Bush administration's interdiction of investigations into the con, what journalist Greg Palast calls the con job, that's K-H-A-N, referring to the Pakistani nuclear scientist at the epicenter of the Pakistani involvement in this. Reviewing from the Greg Palast's website, gregpalast.com, Monday, February 9th, 2004, con job. Bush spiked probe of Pakistan's Dr. Strangelove, BBC reported in 2001. On November 7, 2001, BBC TV and The Guardian of London reported that the Bush administration thwarted investigations of Dr. A.Q. Khan, who this week confessed to selling atomic secrets to Libya, North Korea, and Iran. The Bush administration has expressed shock at the disclosures that Pakistan, our ally in the war on terror, has been running a nuclear secrets bazaar. In fact, according to the British news team sources, Bush did not know of these facts because shortly after his inauguration, his National Security Agency effectively stymied the probe of Khan Research Laboratories. CIA and other agents could not investigate the spread of Islamic bombs through Pakistan because funding appeared to originate in Saudi Arabia. According to both sources and documents obtained by the BBC, the Bush administration's spike of the investigation of Dr. Khan's lab followed from a wider policy of protecting key Saudi Arabians, including the bin Laden family. Despite these tantalizing facts, Abdullah and his operations were A-OK with the FBI chiefs, if not their working agents. Just a dumb snafu? Not according to a top-level CIA operative who spoke with us on condition of strictest anonymity. After Bush took office, he said there was a major policy shift at the National Security Agency. Investigators were ordered to back off from any inquiries into Saudi Arabian financing of terror networks, especially if they touched on Saudi royals and their retainers. That put the bin Ladens, a family worth a reported $12 billion and a virtual arm of the Saudi royal household, off limits for investigation. Bear in mind the bin Ladens were business partners in a number of ways with the Bush family and their extended interests. Continuing, Osama bin Laden was the exception. He remained a wanted man, but agents could not look too closely at how he filled his piggy bank. The key rule of any investigation, follow the money, was now violated, and investigations at least before September 11th began to die. And there was a lot to investigate, or in the case of the CIA and FBI under Bush, a lot to ignore. Through well-known international arms dealers, I'm sorry, but in this business, sinners are better sources than saints, our team was tipped off to a meeting of Saudi billionaires at the Hotel Royal Monceau in Paris in May of 1996 with the financial representative of Osama bin Laden's network. The Saudis, including a key Saudi prince joined by Muslim and non-Muslim gun traffickers, met to determine who would pay how much to Osama. This was not so much an act of support, but of protection, a payoff to keep the mad bomber away from Saudi Arabia. The crucial question here is that if I could learn about this meeting, how did the CIA miss it? In fact, since the first edition of my book, that, by the way, the best edition, that's the best democracy money could buy, our sources have disclosed that the meeting was monitored by French intelligence. Since U.S. intelligence was thus likely informed, the question becomes, why didn't the government immediately move against the Saudis? I probed our CIA contact for specifics of investigations that were hampered by orders to back off the Saudis. He told us that the Khan Laboratories investigation had been effectively put on hold. You may never have heard of Khan Laboratories, but if this planet blows to pieces this year, it will likely be thanks to Khan Labs creating nuclear warheads for Pakistan's military. Because investigators had been tracking the funding for this so-called Islamic bomb back to Saudi Arabia, under Bush security restrictions, the inquiry was stymied. And I would note that one of the things we have taken stock of in past broadcasts is the fact that many within not only the Pakistani military, but even within Pakistan's nuclear program are sympathetic to Al-Qaeda. The thing that is, well, there are a lot of things disturbing about this, but one of the most disturbing things is concerns the fact that many aspects of this technology may have been disseminated perhaps to Al-Qaeda or other Muslim Brotherhood offshoots, or perhaps to others. And again, using proxy war, the Underground Reich, and we're about to examine Underground Reich's links to the nuclear smuggling. It doesn't take a whole lot of people, whether Muslims or white supremacists in the United States or Europe, to pull something truly devastating. And I think that one should not be too dazzled by the discussion one sees of how the United States is the world's lone remaining superpower, because unfortunately this superpower has a glass jaw. Not only is it extremely vulnerable economically, but one well-placed nuke, say, you know, over the Boulder Dam or some other place that would do huge damage to the Western United States ecology, a very water-vulnerable ecology, we could see this superpower knocked out with one punch, and it wouldn't necessarily take a large number of people to deliver that punch, and it is to be hoped that people within the intelligence community and the military in this and other countries will take stock of this vulnerability and do everything they can to try to prevent such an eventuality. Reviewing quickly a portion of an article that we looked at, again in For the Record 447. This is from the New York Times of February 19, 2004, an article by Craig S. Smith, headlined, Roots of Pakistan Atomic Scandal Traced to Europe. Now, before we get into this discussion, I want to refer interested listeners to For the Record 155. In For the Record 155, we accessed the very last bit of research bequeathed us by the late Paul Manning, author of Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, now available on the Spitfire website. In that discussion, from articles published in 1991, Paul Manning discussed the Bormann Group's role in helping not only to develop the Condor missile, a joint Argentinian-Egyptian guided missile project, but also to develop an Argentinian nuclear program, which also would have been made available to the Iraqis. And again, in examining the Argentine-Egyptian connection, one sees very profound echoes of two of the underground Reich's post-war arenas of operation. Again, from the New York Times of 2/19/2004, skipping down, talking about Dr. Khan. The problem began with the 1970 Treaty of Almelo, under which Britain, Germany, and the Netherlands agreed to develop centrifuges to enrich uranium jointly, ensuring their nuclear power industry a fuel source independent of the United States. Urenco, or the Uranium Enrichment Company, was established the next year with its primary enrichment plant at Almelo, the Netherlands. Security at Urenco was, by most accounts, slipshod. The consortium relied on a network of research centers and subcontractors to build its centrifuges, and top-secret blueprints were passed out to companies bidding on tenders, giving engineers across Europe an opportunity to appropriate designs. By the way, note the principal role in this nexus of the centrifuges. We're going to talk about the genesis of those centrifuges, and we're going to take a look at the direct Nazi/Degussa heritage, the direct underground heritage of Karlheinz Schaub from Dr. Gernot Zippe, who developed these centrifuges while working for the Third Reich's nuclear development program during World War II. Continuing. Dr. Kahn, who worked for a Urenco Dutch subcontractor physics dynamic research laboratory, was given access to the most advanced designs, even though he came from Pakistan, which was already known to harbor nuclear ambitions. A 1980 report by the Dutch government on his activities said he visited the Almelo factory in May of 1972, and by late 1974 had an office there. After Dr. Khan returned to Pakistan with blueprints and supplier lists for uranium enrichment centrifuges at the end of 1975, American intelligence agencies predicted that he would soon be shopping for the items needed to build the centrifuges for Pakistan's bomb. They soon detected a flow of equipment from Europe to Pakistan as Dr. Khan drew on Urenco's network of suppliers using a trusted group of former schoolmates and friends as agents. Skipping down, and this year referred to here is 1987. This is in the time period, by the way, in which the Bush administration had become aware of not only the Pakistani nuclear program, but of its threats to communicate this to Iran. Again, the year 1987. Skipping down. That same year, despite American warnings to Germany that such a sale was imminent, a German firm exported to Pakistan a plant for the recovery of tritium, a volatile gas used to increase the power of nuclear bombs. The company simply called the plant something else to obtain an export license. The Export Control Office didn't even inspect the goods, unquote, said Reinhard Hübner, the German prosecutor who handled the subsequent trial of the company's chief, Rudolf Ortmeyers, and Peter Fink, a German physicist who went to Pakistan to train engineers there to operate the equipment. Both men were sentenced to jail for violating export control laws. But there were clues that the technology had spread even further. A German intelligence investigation determined that Iraq, and possibly Iran and North Korea, had obtained uranium melting expertise stolen from Urenco in 1984, Mr. Hibbs reported in Nucleonics Week several years later. In 1989, two engineers, Bruno Stemmler and Karl-Heinz Schaub, who had worked for Germany's MAN New Technology, another Urenco subcontractor, sold plans for advanced uranium enrichment centrifuges to Iran. They went to Baghdad to help solve problems in making the equipment work. In 1991, after the first Iraq war, international inspectors were stunned to discover the extent of Saddam Hussein's hidden program. Mr. Schaub was later convicted of treason, but only served a little more than a year in jail. Mr. Stemmler died before he could be tried. David Albright, a former weapons inspector for the International Atomic Energy Agency, said he helped retrieve a full set of blueprints from Iraq after the major combat operations ended last year. United States inspectors have not found evidence that Mr. Hussein had restarted his nuclear program, but Mr. Albright said there were still drawings unaccounted for. It's an unnerving issue, said Mr. Albright, who is president of the Institute for Science and International Security. Quote, a lot of nuclear weapons design stuff could be missing in Iraq, unquote. As recently as last year, German customs agents seized high tensile strength aluminum tubes made by a German company and bound for North Korea. The tubes matched the specifications for the housing of Urenco's uranium enriching centrifuges. Now, note again that some of the drawings and technological maps were unaccounted for after the Iraqi war. We're now going to reprise an element that we presented in For the Record 395 before the Iraq war. And one of the things that's worth noting here is that, again, there's no evidence that Iraq had restarted its nuclear program, but that one of the things they had been given by Karl-Heinz Schaub and company, and apparently in collusion with some elements of the German establishment, probably underground Reich-affiliated elements, as opposed to the mainstream democratic German establishment, which is opposing this kind of activity. I would note parenthetically that, like the United States, Germany is not a monolithic society. There are elements in Germany who are profoundly and sincerely democratic and very worldly in their outlook. And then there are also underground Reich elements that are in a very profound position economically and politically, which gives their relatively small number a disproportionate influence. The same is true in the United States. That's a paradigm worth bearing in mind. Now, research credit on the following goes to a listener who got this from iSpy magazine. This is from iSpy's issue 13, page 18. It's called Stealing the Fire. And this is about Karl-Heinz Schaub and his Underground Reich and Third Reich antecedents. Stealing the Fire is an investigative film that provides staggering evidence showing how a German scientist, Karl-Heinz Schaub, who helped develop the centrifuges necessary to extract weapons-grade uranium-235, sold classified documents in the early 1990s to Iraq. The investigation started many, many years ago. In 1992, Eric Nadler, N-A-D-L-E-R, an investigative journalist, began researching material on the underground trafficking of nuclear weapons. 10 years later, he and co-producer John S. Friedman, the founder of the Documentary Center at Columbia University, have released their findings. Nadler told Paperclips magazine, quote, I was working for Frontline on PBS, and I was doing a story about the BCCI scandal, which was a crooked bank based in Pakistan. I was doing a story called The Arming of Saudi Arabia about the hidden history of United States-Saudi relations. I got very disturbed about the hidden history, especially about nuclear stories that weren't being covered. Skipping down. And I produced for Frontline something that aired in 1992, in which our team got classified CIA and DIA documents, which said the following. We know that Saudi Arabia has given $5 billion to Saddam Hussein's nuclear program for the express purpose of building a nuclear bomb, unquote. My investigative team at Frontline got the banks, we got the dates, we got the money transfers, and we put this on American television. We showed that America's biggest ally in the Gulf had given $5 billion to the Hitler of the Gulf to build nuclear weapons. Even though USA Today put it on their television page, it caused barely a ripple in the popular culture. I was interested in nuclear stories from that moment on. Skipping down, speaking of Karlheinz Hushab, he was fascinated by Iraq's determined efforts to create nuclear weapons. By examining the investigation of the United Nations weapon inspectors, he came across a mysterious man, Karlheinz Schaub. Nadler and Friedman thought that by researching Schaub, this would open other doors and reveal the companies behind the covert nuclear trading deals. Schaub was a student of Dr. Gernot Zippe, an Austrian physicist often referred to as the father of the centrifuge. And stealing the fire is as much about the centrifuge as the dirty deals done to get the technology to Iraq. Nadler says the equipment originated in the research laboratories of wartime Germany. Hence, the information supplied by Schaub in 1989 to the Iraqis basically originated from the failed Nazi atomic bomb program. The nuclear scientist worked at the University of Virginia for a while and debriefed the Pentagon on the Russian centrifuge, but parenthetically he had gone to work in the Soviet Union. However, he got homesick and soon to return to Germany and found work at Degussa, an IG Farben subsidiary. Then talking about another Degussa figure who was involved in Federal Republic of Germany nuclear smuggling, this an ex-SS man, Dr. Alfred Beecher, was an SS scientific officer who became the precious metals, who headed the precious metals division at Degussa in the post-war years. He later became nuclear export attaché for the West German government, again an ex-SS man. Turning to a short section from The Death Lobby, How the West Armed Iraq by Kenneth Timmerman, published in hardcover by Houghton Mifflin and copyright 1991, of Degussa / Underground Reich trafficking to Iraq. Two transactions that spring heightened fears that Iraq intended to use the Usarak reactor to produce bomb-grade plutonium. An Italian company, in a semi-clandestine deal, sold Iraq 6 tons of depleted uranium purchased from the West German nuclear consortium, NUKEM. Fearing that NUKEM might not deliver the uranium if they knew it was intended for Iraq, the Italians claimed it was for domestic use in Italy, but they needn't have worried about NUKEM's scruples. The consortium was a wholly owned subsidiary of the German chemicals giant Degussa, which had invented and manufactured Zyklon B, the powerful cyanide gas that streamed out of the showerheads in Hitler's death camps, killing millions of European Jews. Degussa had also played a key role in the Nazi effort to build an atom bomb, stopped only when its Oranienburg works near Berlin were flattened by U.S. bombers in 1945. That same year, the Third Reich was going up in flames. Degussa's chairman, Hermann Schlosser, donated 45,000 Reichsmarks to Hitler's SS. 35 years later, Schlosser was still on the Degussa board, and in 1987, he was awarded the German Federal Merit Cross for his services to industry. One of Schlosser's services was shipping nuclear equipment and materials to almost every developing nation that was known to have a clandestine bomb program. Another was opening the vast Iraqi market to German firms. His readiness to supply nuclear materials to both India and Pakistan had impressed on Saddam Hussein that this was a man he could do business with. We're going to continue with this story and the other side of this program. WFMU archiving the shows on Real Audio. More recent programs streaming at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery. Older shows at a longer URL link to both that address and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. That concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 450. Update on 9/11 proxy war and the Underground Reich being recorded on March 14th of 2004. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.